Radio Power for the People. 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie.
And this is Jeff. Today, host Teresa Wilkie talks with Lucy Bloom, Executive Director of Veronica's Voice, about their mission to empower women to exit from prostitution and sex trafficking. Magdalena House, and their annual celebration, in the words of survivors, joyfully looking forward to the future.
Then, host Jeff Humfeld talks with Michelle Mechie, president of Corey's Network, about their introduction of Corey's Law in the Missouri Legislature and their weekly survivors workshops.
Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Up next is Teresa and her guest.
Good morning. This morning we have Lucy Bloom, Executive Director of Veronica's Voice. Veronica's Voice was founded in 2000 by Christy D. Childs, and it's a Kansas City-based organization named in honor of a murdered sex-trafficked friend, Veronica Neverdusky. Veronica's Voice has a stated mission to empower women to exit from, to prevent the entry into, and to end all demand for prostitution sex trafficking in the United States through survivor leadership. Christy's vision and passion has been seen through a host of services for victims, as well as education, advocacy, and legal work to target the demand and avert entry into the cycle of abuse and prostitution. So, Lucy, Christy Childs was the executive director, and now you're executive director. When did you get that job?
Yes. I mean, Veronica's Voice has been providing services for 19 years, and so it was very hard-earned move for Christy to step into the position as our president and founder and for her to bring in an executive director. I came in 18 months ago in this position. I had previously been on the board in 2015, and I'm just so honored to be working with this organization in the position that I am, and then also to be able to work alongside Christy Childs.
So 18 months, and you're the executive director. There's a staff and an office in Kansas City. And can you give us the contact information for Veronica's Voice?
Yes. First, I'd love for you all to be aware of our website, veronicasvoice.org. We have a general email that you can reach out to, admin@veronicasvoice.org. Our general admin phone number is 816-483-7101. And then you can also find us on Facebook, on Instagram. We do have a Twitter. We try to reach people any way that they are already out there, you know, looking for information. And then we also have a referral line or crisis line for individuals or people who are reaching out on behalf of individuals for them to receive services. And that number is 913-214-1401.
I want to second that compliment to your website. Veronicasvoice.org is one fabulous website. You all should
Thank
be
you.
Very, very proud of that. It has a lot of information, and we're going to talk about all that information before our time on Jaws is over. But let's start with the issue of sex trafficking, and specifically how this is an issue for women, how selling sex is labor exploitation, and I want to cite the lack of options for many women, including immigrants. So 18 months, that's over a year. What do you see is your general population? They're all women, correct? Or are there boys? Are there young boys? Probably.
Who are being exploited
yes,
in
sex
Kansas
trafficked, yes.
Yes, it is. that this is a crime that primarily targets women, but there are males who are exploited, both adult and minor, as well as females who are being exploited. And you know, when you're talking about people that are coming here from other countries are being trafficked into our community, one of the areas that both sides of the state line are working on is identifying if and where there is trafficking happening among the massage parlors, because we have illicit massage parlors. And very similar to the same way that the people that are working in massage parlors, they end up living in that massage parlor. They end up having very limited communication and contact with the outside world, so to speak, other than the customers coming into their shops. The women and men who are being trafficked in Kansas City that are Americans, they experience those same types of dynamics of being controlled and being isolated. So the options for people that are being trafficked get so limited because of the power and control of those that are manipulating them.
Now, you and I have talked a few times before this interview, and you don't really see prostitution as a choice, a calculated choice that a person goes into for a career. You see them as victims of trafficking, as if they have no control over their experience. Do you want to say a few words about why you think that or what you see in the area? Because I don't have as much experience with the general area.
Yes, well, the training ground for a person to enter prostitution is a training ground of abuse and severe trauma. So the number one common shared experience of persons who find themselves being trapped in prostitution, they share a background of childhood sexual assault that goes most of the time unidentified, and if identified, untreated. And they end up just with a thinking towards themselves as, this is all I'm good for. This is all that I can do. The average age of entry is still between the ages of 12 and 14, entering into a life where you are being bought and sold. So that in and of itself is reducing so many options from you because you haven't had the opportunity to complete your education. About 60% of women who are in their adult life being prostituted, they have not had the privilege of acquiring their high school equivalency. When you look at what other options, why don't they just run, and why don't they just get another job? There's a lot of factors that play into that. The grooming process is one where the traffickers are very adept at convincing them that they're going to be providing them everything that they need, everything that they're lacking, everything that they're not getting in their home life. They very slowly lure them in a way that by the time that they are trapped, they feel like they did it to themselves. And the breaking process, but before they turn them out, again, is a process of traumatizing them in such a manner that they don't feel that what's being done to them by anybody else is harming them anymore. There's even some traffickers that are adept at being able to break the personality to a point where they can get them to a place where they'll assume a whole nother identity, and it's the brain's way of being able to survive the whole system. So when you talk about calculating and deciding to go into this as a career, for the majority of people, that was calculated and that was decided by somebody who was going to make a profit off of their abuse.
And I want to talk about the effects on the women's health. There are sexually transmitted diseases. There are pregnancy. That doesn't, particularly if a woman is coming into common, frequent, unwanted sex, childhood molestation, and pregnancies from that, then you've got a child, and there are all kinds of responsibilities that sort of confuse your ability to go to school and study for tests and get to work on time. And I see it's a terrible, potentially terrible existence. I read online, there's a very good story from a woman that grew up in Chicago, and she was sexually abused. She was being raised by her grandmother, who was an alcoholic, and she would come home with bar friends, men, and grandma would continue drinking and not be aware that these men would then have sex with the granddaughter, who was a child. She was 10 and 12 years old. And so she was living like this, and in the streets, she saw these women standing on the corner, and they looked beautiful and shiny. They looked beautiful. Their hair was done. They were nicely dressed. They had things she didn't have. And so that looked attractive to her. And she did go one day when she was 14 and sold sex. And she did this three times. The first time she came home with $400, and her grandmother was like, well, hooray, because they were starving. You know, they needed money for the lights. And so she did this three times, and then she was grabbed by pimps who were angry with her for selling sex without a sponsor, and they locked her in a closet for months and starved her. And I guess this is a common part of the whole sex trafficking, the cruelty of pimps. The big crime are really the pimps. Is this impossible to enforce laws against people that run sex trafficking? What do you think?
Yes. Well, those pimps were feeling threatened that she was getting money that they weren't the ones collecting. So basically they were saying that was their, that was their corner, that was their street, and their girls work there. And if she wants to work there, she better become one of them. It is very grievous that there are such dangerous people who themselves have backgrounds of trauma and abuse, and now they're putting that on other people in a way that is very robbing of their dignity and very robbing of just their own personhood. And that needs to be strongly dealt with. And we do have strong laws in both Missouri and Kansas to deal with traffickers if they're able to catch up to them and put charges on them. One of the scary things about the network of traffickers is they can at times be as powerful behind bars as they can on the streets. So that is very, very, that's very much a dangerous segment of our population, and we need to ever be looking at how do we provide, how do we have justice that at the end has a restoration factor to it for people that would seek to impose so much harm on others. And, you know, you've got to wonder what is the level of you know, of sociopathy in those types of situations that is being played out. But, you know, when we think about, so if you think about one of those pimps and they have maybe 5 to 20 girls that they're controlling and that, you know, they have working for them, well, each one of those girls serving 20 to 50 men a day, you know, that's a lot of buyers out there. That's a huge consumer base. And a study that they did out of University of Arizona looking at 14 cities across the country and what is the number of consumers of sex. They found that in Kansas City, it was just over 106,000 consumers of sex. That is what is driving it. the person that gave her that $400 was a buyer. That's how she got that, was from the consumers. And if we, you know, just like with any other product, if you can stop the, if you can get people to not spend their money that way, right? If they can, you know, we would hope moral conscience could be raised in Kansas City to where we would have a community that when children are running from something, they're not running into somebody who wants to exploit them even further. You know, I've heard people say, well, it's happened to her before, what's one more? Or I've heard buyers say, well, I'm not violent like some of the other buyers. Or you know what, you are feeding a system by your consumerism that is perpetuating terroristic levels of trauma and abuse on vulnerable people who see no other options. And while they might know how to dress them up, for them to stand in a corner, and I would dare say in this weather they're not dressed very warmly, you know, but for you know, to say, oh, they look so nice, they've got these clothes on, and then, you know, if you really take a look, there are scars and there are bruises that run
there's
deeper
a lot
than
of
the
violence,
surface
from the pimps and from
and
the customers
from the buyers. Yes. Veronica, mm-hmm. she lost her life at the hand of a buyer.
It's a very, very sad story, and Christy's vision and passion has been seen through a host of services for victims, as well as education, advocacy, and legal work to target the demand and avert entry into the cycle of abuse and prostitution. So the very first thing, people, is if you see it, if you see the child sexual abuse, if you see people walking into a massage parlor at curious hours of the day and night. If you see women going in through the alley into a massage parlor in curious costumes to be giving therapeutic massages, you need to recognize what you're seeing and call that out and say something. We can all live with it. We can all live with a massage parlor on our downtown block. But we don't have to, and it's not good for the victims of the sex trafficking industry. And it's really not good for the people who buy sex either. This is something that needs to be addressed and corrected. Now, I want to talk about some of the services with Veronica's voice. Tell me about Magdalene KC. What is that program?
Yes, Christy's dream from the very beginning was, how do we create a pathway out for other women who are coming behind me? And she's a huge natural mentor and leader. And the primary things was, where are they going to live and where are they going to work? So her dream has been housing and jobs for survivors from the get-go. We had our safe center for more than a decade right off of Troost. And spent a lot of years just in the advocacy piece of educating the community of this issue and the needs of survivors to get to the place where we could have our own house and all of that. And so I'm very happy to say that now we do have our residential program open. It's called Magdalene KC. Our house is in Kansas City, Kansas. And we have also launched we call it our Justice Enterprise. We are a mission with a business. And so the women, they have developed and create a line of body care products that assist in recovery. And then we're also, Denton's Law Firm has come alongside of us, and they are donating gently used professional clothing to us that we can resell to the general population. And then we also partner with other organizations that are also working with women and men that are rebuilding their lives after a life of commercial sexual exploitation, and they can come and get outfitted at no cost to them. So it's a way for us to give back and to sew into jobs for our women. So I raise money not only to be able to provide the safety and the sanctuary where they can invest in their deep healing, but also that we can hire them and they can learn that they can work in a place that is safe and that understands their trauma, that understands what the investment they're making in their recovery. They can start to pay off the fines that they have, child support, fines that they have as well. And it is a, by the time they're able to get out of this life, if they've spent any number of years in it, they have such an uphill battle. It takes a community to come around them and say, you belong here, and we're going to do this journey with you, for them to be successful at really making it out.
Lucy, thank you for that. This is a great time for you to give your telephone number and website again. And understand, listeners, if you are a victim of sex trafficking, if you know of someone who's a victim of sex trafficking, or if you would like to help Veronica's Voice, if you have any experience with the terrible mental mindset of this kind of life and would like to give love and support to other people that are sex trafficked, contact Veronica's Voice. What are those contact information?
Yeah, our general office phone number is 816-483-7101. And then our referral line for services is 913-214-1401.
Now, you have current needs and volunteer needs on your website. It's a fabulous website. I really encourage everyone to take a look at it. So tell me what a list of current needs and volunteer needs are at Veronica's Voice.
I would love for you all to be aware. We do a point-in-time search every October, and so this year is going to be October 17th, 18th, and 19th, but it's a search for missing children in the Kansas City area. We call it the Big Search KC. And we mobilize hundreds of volunteers through that search. You know, and it's to build the capacity of our community to understand persons who are missing, kind of understand what they're going through, understand that they are endangered regardless of the reason that they're running, and that we need a safe, supportive community for them to run to when they are in danger. The reason that thugs and pedophiles and
violent crime offenders
find these kids when they go on the run, the reason the pimps find them, they're looking for them. And, you know, oftentimes we look for a missing child when they first go missing and the news hits. But then as time goes on, as the months and the years go on, we may not even know what they look like. So we may be right next to them in Quick Trip or at the library or another place out in our community and not realize that the person next to us is somebody that's missing. And for the reasons I already mentioned, you know, if they are trapped in this life, the chances that they're going to ask for help, please help me, you know, is very slim. Those please help me times usually come at the beginning of a breaking cycle like this. And so once they're trapped in this life, it's very difficult for them to ask for help. So it's important that every sector of our community knows who these kids are and knows how to report. And it's simple. If you see somebody that you believe is missing, dial 911 and give as much detailed information as you can. Other volunteer opportunities that we have in our social enterprise, we a lot of volunteer love is put into that business, helping us with the products, helping us with our website, helping us with events, and then we have lots of other opportunities to assist with also educating the community about how to come around this issue and create a Kansas City where this crime is not so prolific.
That's all available on your website. Now, you have an upcoming event, an evening of inspiration from poetry and short stories authored by survivors of commercial sexual exploitation and performances by local artists. It's heavy hors d'oeuvres and desserts, drinks, a silent auction, March the 30th, 6 to 8 p.m. at Meadowlark Event Center, 20650 West 191st Street, Spring Hill, Kansas. Tickets are available at the Veronica's Voice website.
Yes.
And the great beauty of listening to survivor stories is you begin to understand, Lucy, that there isn't a particular personality type. Some people that are victims of sex trafficking can be very confident appearing and outspoken. Some can be very quiet and appear to be wounded, so there isn't anything to look for. And to listen to the stories of people, that's what we begin to understand, how it just is. If you see it, listeners, make sure you call it out, but you have to help. Thanks much, Lucy.
Thank you.
Now the calendar for the week of March 4th. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, March 4th from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, Kansas City, Missouri. The Criminal Justice Task Force mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and basic human rights for those that are incarcerated. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob2655@yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, March 5th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. You're invited to Call Out, an Arts in Prison fundraising gala, Saturday, March 9th, in the Capitol Federal Ballroom at the Regnier Center, Johnson County Community College, 12345 College Boulevard, Overland Park, Kansas. The program will include the stories of former prisoners who have turned their life around through their participation in the arts. There will be a silent auction of art created by inmates and former prisoners engaged with the Arts in Prison program. Reception and silent auction begin at 6:30 p.m., dinner and program at 7:15 p.m. Please reserve your spot by emailing info@artsinprison.org. The second annual Ex-Offender Job Fair, sponsored by Kansas City, Missouri Council members from the 5th and 6th District, will be held Wednesday, March 13th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 9701 Marion Park Drive, Kansas City, Missouri. Be prepared as a variety of local businesses will be there to take resumes and conduct interviews. For more information, contact Officer Aaron Whitehead at 816-949-1634 or Officer Mary McCall at 816-672-2828. My name is Teresa Wilkie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Bill Claus.
And this is Jeff Humfeld. We're back with Jaws of Justice Radio. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking with Michelle Metzke. She is the founder, along with her husband, Robert, of Corey's Network Incorporated. And this all started because in July 2013, her 22-year-old son, Corey, was attacked by an acquaintance just a few blocks from their home. He stumbled home. His brother found him bleeding in his bedroom with a large cut to his neck and his midsection. He died in his mother's arms, but they were able to revive him. And three or four times before he finally had a massive stroke that ended his life. And she went through, she and her family went through just a saga, working with the police and everybody else that wouldn't listen to her. And it took a number of years before his killer was finally apprehended and put on trial and convicted. So welcome to Jaws of Justice. Michelle, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well.
Good. And like he said, my name is Michelle Metzke.
Yep.
And I'm very pleased to be here. I think this is the fourth or fifth time I've been able to join you.
Yes, mainly on Corey's stuff, but also we're going to talk about a lot of different things today. So we're going to get right down to it. The first thing that we do want to talk about, because we want people to understand how they can get involved and make this happen, is Corey's Law. And this is something that's been introduced, and it came out of some of the missteps that happened in Corey's case. So why don't you give us a little bit of information on what happened in Corey's case that, you know, basically made this law something you felt was necessary?
Well, like you said, he did die several times, and there was a point in the process where they thought he was going to live. So I don't know if the missteps came from that particular thought or if it happened before that thought. I have my own opinions, but what happened is Corey was brought into the hospital. His clothing was then collected. We don't have any assurances as to how it was collected or anything else. And between the second time that he died and the fifth time he died, somehow Corey's clothing got thrown away in the biohazard. Of course, we know with DNA evidence and all of the different fibers and hair and et cetera that could have possibly been brought into the case at that point, that evidence seemed to be completely and totally lost. So, and I wasn't aware that this was happening until a police detective came running into the hospital room and said, where are Corey's clothes? Of course, my whole family was there to be able to witness this as well. And we said, you're supposed to have those clothes because of the chain of evidence. You're supposed to have those. And he says, well, we don't have them, and ICU doesn't have them, and they're not up here, so we need to know where they are. So I went to ICU, and I said, do you have Corey's clothes? And they said, no, check with ER. So I went to ER, and I said, do you have Corey's clothes? They said, no, check with the security department. I asked security. Security said, no, they should be with the police. I went back up, and I spoke to the people in the ICU, and two of the nurses were kind enough to go down and wade through all of the biohazard material and pull Corey's clothing out. It was bagged, but I was told at that time, which was July of 2013, that his clothing had been contaminated, which leads you to believe that there's a hole in the bag or it was open or something like that. So for about 18 months, they continued to tell me that Corey's clothing was contaminated, and it wasn't until I confronted them and brought in the name of their bosses and et cetera and some other people from politics that they finally admitted that Corey's clothing was never contaminated, that it was inside of an evidence bag, and they were going to send it out after a year and a half, which means we had to wait 2.5 years before we ever found out anything about Corey's clothes. Like I said, it's questionable as to how they were collected because there was no evidence on Corey's clothing whatsoever of another person, which is hard to believe with touch evidence and trace evidence and et cetera. In this day and age, because a murder is something, especially a knife murder, that is something you do up close. And in this particular case, the person was able to gouge the right side of his neck, and then when Corey turned around to face him, he stabbed him through the liver. So that meant that he had to have been extremely close to be able to get the knife in that far. So there should have been some kind of transfer. So we contacted Rory Rowland, which is a Democratic House representative in Independence, and we told him about the situation almost immediately after it happened. And he started working on what is known as Corey's Law, otherwise known as Bill Number 1071, House Bill 1071. And the first thing that it would do is it would require nurses to receive 3 hours of forensic collection training. This would therefore make sure that the clothing doesn't hit the floor, make sure that you collect it with gloves on your hands, make sure that you don't shake it out, make sure that it's taken directly off the person in as pristine of a way as possible. And we understand that you're trying to save someone's life, but that we're talking about someone separate from the team trying to save his life that would just collect the evidence. The second part is it would require potential evidence to be stored in a locked box and not discarded until the police actually say, you know, verbally or even by written protocol, say, you may throw this away. Either that or they sign and say, we've received this evidence. And then that way the chain of evidence would never be broken. And then the third thing is we found out during this process that that it's the law that the hospitals have to report dog bites, that is, and they have to report gunshot wounds, but they do not have to report knife wounds. So as part of this, we're also asking that that knife wounds be reported as well, so that more of our individuals that are being attacked and assaulted and et cetera are actually that information is being left to the police officer and not to the hospital as to whether or not it's a crime.
Okay, I want to go to the House bill here just a little bit. I want people to understand that they can, you know, help this bill along if that's what they want to do. You know, I went on to the House website last night, the MissouriHouse.gov, I believe is how it is, and it has had two readings, which is you know, the first step. It has not been assigned to a committee, nor and until it is assigned to a committee, it won't have a public hearing, and it will not appear on the calendar for a vote. So, you know, the way for people to do something about this is contact the Speaker of the House, Elijah Hare, and he is in room 308 at the Capitol. His legislative assistant is Marietta Rutledge, and the phone number in his office is 573-751-2210. His email is elijah.hare, and that's H-A-A-H-R. At house.mo.gov, G-O-V. And that's a way that you can just ask his office, tell him that, hey, you want to see this bill come forward and be discussed on the floor and get a vote this year. So I just wanted to make sure that we didn't get past the House bill here without talking about how you can be involved.
Thank you.
You know, I've known you for some time now, and I know this is all, you know, it's like it's yesterday for you every time you talk about it. And we want to thank Representative Roland for his sponsorship in writing this bill, and you might contact his office too and tell him thank you as well. You know, your experience with what happened with your son and what happened to your family as you went through this process is something that urged you on to bring Corey's Network into existence. And there's a couple different things that you're doing now that we really want people to know about. And one is something you've started here just this last fall called the Survivors Workshop. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the Survivors Workshop is, and then we can talk a little bit about individual workshops and what you do and that this is ongoing.
Okay. Our Survivors Workshop has been in the works for about a year before we started it. We have a highly educated board of directors that did research and other information gathering throughout, you know, of course, articles and books et cetera and et cetera. So it was a long process because we wanted to make sure that whatever we brought out was going to be good for the community. And there are many groups that are doing amazing work that are out there that do things for support, and they do therapeutic grief counseling. And what we were seeing is that in some cases, people don't go back because they feel as though they're getting vicariously traumatized by some of the information. Now, for some people, it works amazing. It's like AA, you know, if you go and you put the program into place, it's absolutely wonderful for them. But there are still some people out there that were kind of looking for something different. And we are not a group of counselors. We're a group of social workers and researchers and medical people and et cetera. And what we wanted was a group that would not vicariously traumatize someone. And what that means is if I tell you about my son's murder and then you tell me about your son's murder, then you and I both start sharing each other's grief. And it starts heaping up on you when you start hearing 20 and 30 of these stories in an evening or you know, in the last couple of weeks, et cetera. And it gets to a point where you feel so down that you can't get back up. So what we wanted to do was be able to create a program that helps people gain the building blocks to be able to survive something like this. So that instead of coming in and talking necessarily about your loved one, we do know everyone's story. We do know everyone has shared information about what's going on with them. But what we do is rather than trying to counsel out the ideas, we instead try to give them different building blocks. For example, tonight we will have, we'll be doing a media module, and it's our second one. The first one we had Toriana Porter of the Kansas City Star who came out and talked to the people so that they would understand how to get into a newspaper and some of their rights and responsibilities as far as media is concerned. And then tonight we're going to have Sarah Plake from KSHB. So she'll be in there talking with all of our victims and giving them more information about when you should and shouldn't talk to the media, what things you should keep off the record and what things can be on the record and that type of thing. And it basically what it does is it personalizes it for people so that they're not intimidated by the media. The next module is going to be the investigation. Last time we went through it, we had a captain of the police from Kansas City, and then we had Kevin Baim from TIPS, from the TIPS hotline that came out, and they're able to explain to people how those two things work, the investigation into your crime as well as how can you use TIPS to be more likely to get your crime solved. After that is prosecution or court. So we had the prosecuting attorney come in, and we had an advocate come in from a local police department. And they came in and explained from the victim's point of view of how it's going to happen in a court case, and then also from the prosecutor's point of view, how they're going to be able to prosecute a case and what they're looking for as far as their evidence, et cetera. Then we move on to how to move forward. We don't believe in moving on. There's no moving on from this. Like you said, it's as fresh to me today as it was the day that Corey died. And I don't expect anyone else to feel any different. And if they do feel different, God bless them. But it doesn't end when you put your child in the ground. You don't quit loving them when that happens. So that the moving on process, we bring in a certified therapist for that particular part because we want to be able to have people understand what therapy would be able to provide, what other groups there are out there, and all of the different programs that they can be involved in that will help them move forward in their lives so that they don't stop living at that moment that they buried their child, and instead they're able to either encourage others or at least at the very least be able to go on with their own life and be able to remember their loved one in a pleasant way and spend less days crying and more days celebrating, you know, that they have this child with them or this person with them. Now, I did miss the first module because we did that 2 weeks ago. And this is, by the way, this is every Monday except for the third Monday of the month, and I'll explain that in a little while. But it's every Monday except for the third Monday of the month. We go over the same modules. You can see the modules on our upcoming events on our page of Get Involved at CoriesNetwork.org. It says Get Involved, and then down below it says Events Calendars and Upcoming Events. You are welcome to come. It's free. It's at the Church of the Four Corners, otherwise known as the City House, which is, I think you know where it is, Jeff.
I don't have the address right in front of me, but it if you go to 40 Highway and Nolum Road, you have a Planet Fitness or something or other to the east of that, and then just east of that is the church. So it's off of you enter off of 40 Highway just east of the shopping center there where the Hy-Vee is, and that's probably the easiest way to get you there.
And for the old folks in that are listening like me, that used to be Best Buy. So if that gives you any hint, it used to be the Best Buy. But and then just to let you know, the first module is getting started. And what we talk about when we talk about getting started is how different people feel different ways and that all emotions are legitimate. We talk about also what programs are in the city. We have a long list of programs that are also on our website that we partner with other programs, we refer to other programs, we talk with other programs to see how we can best provide help and et cetera. But what we want to be able to do is let them have the ability to go to that place on our website and be able to go to any program in the area that we've connected with and be able to pull that up so that they can get that information for themselves.
Okay. Our time is starting to get a little bit short here, so once again, I want you, if you would, give the website. You're also on Facebook at Cory's Network Incorporated. Is that right?
Correct.
And you can find a lot of this information and the website, for that matter, on the Facebook page if you're on Facebook. You have a phone number for
folks. Our phone number for Cory's Network is a hotline. It's 24 hours a day, Jeff, and that's 816- 834-9161. Again, that's 816-834-9161. And we answer that 24 hours a day. Either I will answer it or my husband Robert will answer it, but someone will answer the phone for you. And we do have the ability now for bilingual individuals that need help. We can also get, we have a board member that is fluent in Spanish, and our website can be converted to any language, I believe, known to man, practically. So we do have those abilities.
Well, you know, so we have Cory's Law. And once again, you want to get a hold of the Speaker of the House, Elijah Hare, H-A-A-H-R, His phone number is 573-751-2210. Let him know that you, if you want to see House Bill 1071, Corey's Law, move forward. He's the one it's in his hands at this moment, and hopefully he'll get it into a committee and it'll get a hearing and come to a vote later this session. Any last words that you want to give us today, Michelle?
I just want to make sure people understand that bringing in this law, we're not asking for anything difficult of either person. We're not saying it's anybody's fault that anything happened with Corey's case. What we are saying is that by putting these two or three steps into place, it's going to make it easier for the hospitals and for law enforcement for them to be able to prosecute a crime. So we hope that you will support us.
Any of this information that we've given here today is on the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, which is, of course, is kkfi.org. We want to thank you very much for coming on today, and we hope that Corey's Law gets a fair hearing this year and hopefully becomes law.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is taken from the Drug Truth Network program, Century of Lies, hosted by my good friend, Mr. Doug McVeigh.
My name is Zara Snap, and I work with Acción Técnica Social in Colombia and Instituto RIA in Mexico. The role of civil society in the formation, implementation, and evaluation of evidence-based innovative drug policies becomes more urgent each day. As we approach the 2019 ministerial segment, it is our job to bring reality to the forefront. It is our job to ensure that innovations are brought into policymaking. And it is our job to evaluate these innovations in order to improve the lives of people who use drugs, people who produce drugs, and people who form part of the illegal market. While governments change, civil society provides continuity. Our generation, this new generation, has opted to understand substances and not to fear them, so that we can reduce the human and social damage that ignorance regarding psychoactive substances has generated. We know the current approach has not worked. I don't need to tell you about the consequences of these policies in Colombia, in Mexico, or the rest of Latin America. It is evident that the war on drugs has resulted in the criminalization of the most vulnerable populations. Forced eradication of crops hinders cultivating communities. Military interventions in public security perpetuates human rights violations. And prohibition is enlarging an illegal market that already exists. Having the goal of a drug-free or drug abuse-free world is not only unrealistic and impossible, it is actively harmful. In the last decade, civil society, sometimes accompanied by governments, has been responsible for providing direct services, including harm reduction, such as drug checking programs. Many of the people who participate in these programs form part of the 90% of people who use drugs in a non-problematic manner. In the past 5 years, 89% of the people who used our drug checking service, Échele Cabeza, or Check Your Head Before It Goes to Your Head, changed their behaviors. They are now more likely to use lower dosages of drugs, not mix substances, look for health alerts, which we emit, and not use substances when the drug checking result is negative. These services save lives and improve the experience of people who use drugs. Indicators on drug policies have been focusing on eradicated crops, confiscated drugs, and the number of people in prison for drug-related crimes. These are clearly not indicators based on human rights and social welfare. New indicators should be connected to the 2030 SDGs agenda and reflect the impacts of drug policies on health, human rights, development, and peace and security.
We'll have part two with Zara Snap on tomorrow's program. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.